Well, the full force of 2011 is with us, isn't it? What a tumultuous start to this La Niña year for so many of us here in Australia. In Brazil, in Sri Lanka, it's hard to comprehend the scale of it all. Natasha Mitchell on board. Welcome to a year of fresh shows on the rich life of the mind. And comprehending the scale of things is in fact something we're looking into today, but in a totally different context. How's your head for numbers?
You can't take three from two. Two is less than three, so you look at the four in the tens place. Now that's really four tens, so you make it three tens, regroup, and you change a ten to ten ones, and you add them to the two and get 12, and you take away three, that's nine. Is that clear?
Numeracy skills are on the nose in Australia. A 2008 COAG report concluded that half of us, yes, half, don't have the skills needed to meet the complex demands of work and life in a modern economy. It's a common refrain, isn't it? You've heard it. I'm crap at maths. Of course, that can be for many reasons. How it's handled in the classroom, lack of opportunity, or perhaps because our parents have transferred their own fear of maths to us. But as you'll hear today, some of us might legitimately be able to blame our brain or biology. Learning difficulties are genuine. We're more familiar with dyslexia, that difficulty with processing words, but it seems that up to 8% of us struggle with numbers, arithmetic and calculations because of a legitimate condition called dyscalculia, a condition that's flown under the radar for too long. Corinne Podger is on the case.
I do lots of French activities with my dad, create movies with my dolls, dance. I write stories on my computer all the time and we print it out. And my mum takes it to work and shows a man who does lots of scripts and he says she could become a scriptwriter. I'm not trying to brag or anything, but I love writing stories. I love to read and I'm reading a really good book at the moment that my dad got me and I really enjoy reading.
Lucy is nine. She's articulate and quick-witted and fluent in the French, English and Italian, which is spoken at home. Her parents, Astrid and Xavier, are both school teachers. They want her to learn and she likes school. But Lucy's receiving tuition for learning difficulties at an organisation called SPELD, Specific Learning Difficulties Victoria, and here's why.
Can you tell the time right now?
I can read slightly the Roman numerals. 35, but I just can't read because it's something go to, I don't know, but I know it's something 35.
And what time is it, Xavier?
7:30.
Yes.
Lucy has math difficulties. We found that out when she was in prep, and she's been struggling since, and she's not getting it, unfortunately, and I don't know why and how, and it's just very frustrating at times.
Her writing was always very good. It's the maths that has been the issue. We sometimes have the struggle of at school with making people understand that it's not because Lucy doesn't want to do it or can't be bothered. It's because she really cannot do it. You know, she's unable to retain a lot of the information.
Lucy is in a way lucky that we're teachers because we're able to identify and try to remedy. But if you are an average parent and you don't know what's going on, you know, you just think that the kid just needs to work harder and then you put pressure on them and it's just not working.
Lucy has difficulties with auditory processing, a mismatch between ear and brain, but that doesn't fully explain why she can't process numbers as well as other kids her age. She can count, and she's memorised her times tables, but anything involving calculation, multiplying, dividing, telling the time, getting change at the shops, quantities and amounts, is a mystery. Now she's being tested by Professor Bob Reeve, a developmental psychologist at the Mathematical Cognition Laboratory at the University of Melbourne. He believes Lucy's a classic dyscalculic. So what is it?
Some people refer to this as number blindness. What we actually see specific to number is that once they've learnt a concept, such as simple addition, they don't transfer or use that knowledge to study similar ideas like subtraction. Whereas the person who has been poorly taught, who has poor education, still has a basic idea of numeracy concepts. It really seems as if people with dyscalculia don't see the concepts. They can learn by rote to do certain things, but it appears not to transfer or generalize to similar problems and tasks. It is often comorbid with other problems such as dyslexia. Sometimes it's very separate from dyslexia. I think the general agreement now is that there is a pure form that is not associated with other learning difficulties. We suspect that it is genetic or at least a neurological problem in some respects.
Usually, they've always been bad at maths right from the word go. Very often, they will have somebody else in the family who's bad at maths, though not always. Secondly, they don't respond to normal instruction very well. So the kid who's missed some classes and is falling behind, that kid can be brought up to speed with the appropriate additional help, whereas a dyscalculic, he won't be able to catch up. So the dyscalculic needs very specialised interventions in the same way that dyslexics need specialised interventions to help them to learn to read.
One of the world's great maths evangelists, cognitive neuroscientist Professor Brian Butterworth from University College London, author of books like The Mathematical Brain. He's collaborated with Bob Reeve and is a leading light in dyscalculia research.
There are two things that we know about, and we don't know an awful lot at this stage. One is there's an abnormality in the parietal lobes, and the parietal lobes are the critical areas for representing numerical magnitude in the brain. So knowing that fiveness is bigger than fourness, that's a parietal lobe function. And we know that there's abnormality in the critical little bit of the parietal lobe that represents number magnitude. Elizabeth Isaacs at the Institute of Child Health and her colleagues have found that there's less grey matter in that little bit of brain in her dyscalculics than there were in her control group. Another group in Stanford, led by Vinod Menon, have found that the connections between this part of the parietal lobe and other parts of the brain are different in dyscalculics. The other thing that's now known is that the activity in these areas is different in dyscalculics than in matched controls. So we think that both structure and functioning are different in dyscalculics. Now, of course, there's a problem about causal relationships here. So if you don't do much maths because you're dyscalculic, does that reduce the grey matter density in the relevant bit of brain? Does it change the way in which connectivity is set up? Does it change the pattern of activation? Or is it the other way around, that you start off with different grey matter density and this leads to dyscalculia? These are things that we're only now beginning to investigate, because only now have we got information about brain abnormalities in these dyscalculic learners.
The first person with dyscalculia that you came across, a woman called Kathy, how did she process numbers?
Well, she processed them really badly. So if you asked her what 9 plus 6 was, she would have great difficulty doing that. Yet she was able to program computers. She was able to run a small software business. But for her, it was really, really difficult. And we asked her to describe her mental picture of numbers. And that was really, really strange. Because what she would do is she'd say, well, I have this mental picture, and I'll draw it out for you, of what the numbers look like. And she'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I've got the next lot of numbers, which are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then I've got the next lot of numbers, which are 10, 11, 12, and so on up to 20. So she was representing 5 twice in her mental picture, and she was representing 10 twice and 20 twice, so that when she tried to count through in the way that, say, an early learner would count through, she got things wrong. So she had a very, very abnormal mental representation.
What do we know about the causes of dyscalculia? Is it inherited?
We think it's inherited in a lot of cases. We don't know if it's inherited in all cases. We know it's inherited from twin studies, so if one identical twin has it, the other identical twin is very likely to have it. We also know that it persists into adulthood. There was a study done by Ruth Shalef in Tel Aviv which showed that of the dyscalculics that she tested at age 11, most of them were dyscalculic at the age of 17, and almost all of them were still very poor at arithmetic. So it's something you're almost certainly born with, though it may not be heritable in some of those cases, and it persists. And we've been doing studies of lots of what we call high-functioning dyscalculics, who are dyscalculic even though they're very successful in their work, and they're very intelligent and have had all the advantages.
From the three, you then use one to make eight ones. You add those ones to the three, and you get 1 3 base eight, or in other words, in base 10, you have 11, and you take away 7, and 7 from 11 is 4.
Someone who's had all the advantages is Professor Paul Moorcraft, with a distinguished career in the military and international affairs. He now heads up the Centre for Foreign Policy Analysis in London, and we spoke on a crummy phone line as he headed off to oversee Sudan's independence referendum. Paul was diagnosed dyscalculic by Professor Butterworth a few years ago.
His body suddenly dictates a number to me over the phone, for example. I can't remember more than two or three numbers. And when I physically write them down, I will inadvertently transpose them. I have trouble reading train timetables. To actually explain what it is difficult to do. I just cannot understand maths. It's not a phobia. It's not a psychological thing. It is a physical inability. Even no matter how hard I try, and even though I'm a professor, I cannot write down numbers. And I have a spatial awareness problem when it comes to numbers. If you're talking about dimensions of something, I had trouble visualizing that. I worked in the Ministry of Defense, and I had a safe, and I was, you know, there's documents, and you weren't supposed to write down the numbers down for security reasons. And I used to add up with your fingers, which is a bit embarrassing if you're in senior meetings in Whitehall in London. So I hid it for many, many years.
Now, there would be a lot of people listening to this thinking, ah, that sounds like me, I'm dyscalculic. But you found that it's not very common.
It's about as common as dyslexia. So it's somewhere between 3 and 6%. Those are the best prevalence estimates that we have at the moment. So that means one child in each class is probably going to be dyscalculic on average. And if you look, for example, at the economic consequences of this, they're actually rather serious. If you could just get the bottom 10% of arithmetic learners up to the minimum OECD level, which isn't very high, then you would increase GDP growth by quite a lot. So, for example, in England, if we could get the 10%, half of those will be dyscalculic, up to the minimum level, that would increase our GDP growth by 0.44%. That doesn't sound very much, but if you know that GDP growth in the UK is, say, 2%, an additional 0.44 is actually a 25% increase in GDP growth. So I think one of the things that's really important going forward is to find effective ways of getting dyscalculics up to at least a reasonable level of competence at arithmetic, and that's one of the things that we're currently trying to do.
You've designed a test for dyscalculia, which I understand is used in schools in Britain. Now, how does it work?
We wanted a test which, as far as possible, didn't depend upon your educational experiences. So if you have a standard arithmetic test, then if you've been to a good school, you're going to be better at it on the whole than if you've been to a bad school. So we wanted something that was very simple and something which targeted these simple functions in the parietal lobe. So the critical tests in our screener for dyscalculia is how quickly and accurately you can enumerate objects in a display, how quickly you can say there are 5 objects there, and how quickly and how accurately you can compare two numbers, how quickly you can say that 5 is bigger than 3. And we find this is highly predictive of your ability to do arithmetic. It distinguishes between kids who are bad at arithmetic because they're dyscalculic and therefore will be bad on these enumeration and comparison tests from kids who are bad at arithmetic but are not bad on those two tests. And what we say in the screener notes is that if you're bad at arithmetic but good at enumeration and comparison, then you're not dyscalculic. There's another reason for why you're bad at arithmetic, and that the teacher or the educational psychologist then has to try and find out what it is that's gone wrong in your particular education.
Brian Butterworth, dyslexic kids are being picked up earlier and earlier, but what about dyscalculia? Well, you can't screen for it before age 6, but Bob Reeve and colleagues are working on spotting infants, even babies, who can't process numeric information years before they encounter maths.
We've started to go back pretty much to infancy to look at the precursors of number, and they're not going to look like what you think of as number, as in counting. So we see them as quantity, the recognition of very small sets of number. The most obvious one that people look at is approximate number. whether children can discriminate between sort of two sets of numbers, or infants can discriminate between two sets of numbers.
And two sets of things.
Two sets of things, two sets of objects, two sets of dots, two sets of lines. The idea is that the closer the two sets are together, the more difficult it is to discriminate between them. And so the ability to discriminate between similar sets is termed approximate number, and in some sense it's seen as a precursor for the development of symbolic number, or of what we might think of as Arabic number. And the idea is that these very basic forms of quantity discrimination support or scaffold the later forms of number. If those early bases are not there, then it is very difficult to scaffold or associate these later forms with what we might think of as the cultural development of number, addition, subtraction, and counting, and so on.
These sound like abstract difficulties, but research worldwide indicates that they point to dyscalculia. So are there interventions, and can they work? Well, it's early days.
We don't have an intervention science at this particular point in time, and we don't know if it can be remedied. And certain people argue, and it's a very negative argument, that because it is likely that pure dyscalculia is a brain difficulty, you may not be able to teach it in the same way as you teach other things for that particular group of people.
We know it's lifelong for some people. We don't know if they would have still been dyscalculic if they'd had the appropriate intervention. We think that the way to help them is to strengthen what we call basic number concepts. So getting them to do plenty of practice with enumeration, with counting, with comparing numbers, and doing very simple addition and subtraction, so they have a feel for numbers which the rest of us take for granted, but which they find very difficult to achieve.
Difficult, but not impossible, as you're about to hear, here on All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, going global on Radio Australia and on podcast. I'm Corinne Podger.
Ten cookies, looking mighty fine. Cookie Monster, eat one. Another nine. Nine cookies where there used to be 10. Wish that me could have 10 cookies again.
Most people have automaticity with a lot of these things, but people with dyscalculia have to learn the steps. They just don't have it automatically. They often resort to very primitive methods of calculating or adding or subtracting or whatever they do, because they haven't developed any strategies for moving on from just doing a one-by-one count.
Mary Delahunty is a special education mathematics teacher in Melbourne. Her approach is to fix number concepts in her students' minds firmly enough so they're not always struggling with the basics. She also helps them to find workarounds so that they can survive in our numeric world.
Just to give you an example of one little boy that I've worked with for over 12 months, he was about 9 or 10 at the time, and his parents contacted me quite distraught. They had two reports from psychologists that he would never get anywhere with his mathematics. There was no point in worrying about it. He was able to count, but just counting by ones, and then he'd go back, and when he needed to calculate, he would go back and then he'd count the first bit, and then he'd count the second bit, and then he'd count the whole lot.
So perhaps at the age of 9, his development in mathematics was of a much younger child?
I would say he was probably operating at a preschool student that we would expect to be able to sort and sequence at that time. I used a multi-sensory approach so that every time they touched something, they could sort of feel this was a multiple of something, this was another bit to add on. We used buttons to work our additions, and he could go back and check. So after a while, he got the idea that he could hold that number, that quantity in his mind. That led him to be able to actually use his memory rather than overload it to hold a concept in his mind of what a number looked like and what the quantity was.
Mary's put together a goodie box of beans, beads, blocks and seeds to give numbers shape, substance and hopefully meaning.
It turns on the senses. It helps to print the image in your mind. When you feel something, you can often transfer that into the image of what it looks like, what it feels like. We have icy pole sticks. I have magnetic marbles so we can make groups of things so that you can chain and unchain them. We made bean sticks to count by tens. And so sometimes they're on that same continuum as all the other students, but they need that many more exposures to something before they actually can take it in and hold it in their memory. Our working memory is really important because what we've implanted in our mind, we don't have to go back and redo. We're not using our memory to overload what we do so we can move on. So it's very important that we actually can form those images.
There's also problems sometimes with understanding time, which comes down to numbers, mm-hmm. but it includes concepts mm-hmm. like after and before.
Mm. Dealing with time, what I get the children or the students to do is, first of all, stick gum nuts, stick anything on around the clock, so that when they go past the 12, they can shut their eyes, touch it. Most of our counting around the clock is by fives or by tens, or going halfway up the hill and halfway down the hill. So what I get them to do is I actually get them to make a continuous length. So we make our clock with a tape and then we spread it out along the ground. We can double it and make a hill out of it. So we're going up the hill and down the hill. Once we've learned to count by fives, we can do it with a clock. We roll it back up, put it back into the circular shape so they can see it.
Is there a level beyond which people with dyscalculia can't progress in the sense that somebody who's blind, for example, isn't going to be able to see?
We can't cure some of these things. We can improve how they do it, but we can also give them shortcuts. We know that we can use talking calculators to help support students so that when problems are presented, they can listen to it being stated first. That helps them to process it in their mind and to get the information correct, or remember a pattern for something. That helps short-circuit what you need to do to be able to calculate.
Mary Delahunty's gumnut arsenal sounds like it's working wonders. Professor Brian Butterworth wants to know the extent to which dyscalculia might be overcome. He's designed online classes so that dyscalculic children can do basic maths tasks over and over again. He's found it does improve arithmetic ability and wants to find out if it also boosts brain function.
It's been done for dyslexia, and we know that with the right kinds of intervention, patterns of activation in the relevant parts of the reading brain change. And one of the interesting things in the dyslexia literature is that the changes are towards making brain activity more normal. Now, it wasn't obvious that that was going to be the outcome. One possibility is that the dyslexic reading brain would find a different way of doing effective reading from the rest of us. But what they, in fact, they found was that the dyslexic brain became more like a normal brain after the intervention. So one of the things that we're interested in with dyscalculia is whether intervention makes the dyscalculic brain more normal, or whether the intervention just helps the dyscalculic learner find a different way of doing the same task.
There's been quite a vigorous debate about whether dyscalculia, the neurological difficulty with numbers and maths, is entirely distinct from dyslexia, a difficulty with words and language. Has that debate been settled?
I think it has, but other people don't agree with me about this. The problem is that kids who have dyslexia often have dyscalculia, and kids who have dyscalculia often have dyslexia, but not all of them do. So you find kids who are just dyscalculic and kids who are just dyslexic. And if you look at the parts of the brain that are involved in reading, they scarcely overlap at all with the parts of the brain that are involved in arithmetic. That's one reason for thinking that they're distinct. We're beginning to understand better the kinds of genes that are involved in dyslexia, and they don't seem to be genes that are involved in dyscalculia. So again, at the genetic level, there seems to be a difference. But it might be that there's some common cause for both dyslexia and dyscalculia. We don't know that yet, and that seems entirely possible. What I think to me is clear, but to many people in the dyslexia business is not clear, is that dyslexia doesn't cause dyscalculia. So the fact that you're not very good at reading, of course, is going to handicap you in lessons, but in itself, it doesn't actually affect your ability to represent numbers in the brain.
Dyscalculia can be a lifelong disability, but like dyslexia, it's not recognised as such by Australia's Disability Discrimination Act, which is deliberately broad in an attempt to be inclusive. But it leaves schools with no clear guide on who to prioritise for extra help. Last year, the National Dyslexia Working Party urged the federal government to create a new disability category, that of specific learning difficulties. The recommendation was made with dyslexia in mind, but Working Party member Dr. Nola Firth from the Murdoch Children's Research Institute says it could also cover dyscalculia, echoing moves abroad.
In, say, America and Canada and the UK, the words specific learning disabilities are actually in the disability discrimination legislation. But here they're not. Because we haven't got it specifically stated in law as specific learning disabilities, it's not so well understood here. Perhaps if I can talk a little bit about the history, there was an inquiry in the 70s in the Senate as to whether the specific learning difficulties, it was called at that stage, existed. And in our country, unfortunately, we decided that it was due to bad teaching, it didn't exist. Whereas at a similar time in America, Canada and the United Kingdom, they came to a different conclusion, and they were in fact right and we were wrong. It was done with the best of intentions, but I think as a result of that, we've lagged behind here. In those all those countries, all teachers have a mandatory requirement of education in dyslexia and dyscalculia. It's a specific learning disability, so it covers both. It's important so that people who have had an informed diagnosis know that they are entitled to reasonable adjustments, which is the words that's used, right throughout their lives. It starts in kindergartens, primary school, secondary school, tertiary education, and then the workplace, so that they can reach their true potential, which in fact might be very high. People can be gifted and have either of these conditions.
There is still a strong belief that you can teach all children anything. But if you have a subgroup of atypical children, as in dyscalculia, who may need special exposure to teaching practice, we should know about that. We should actually do something about it. We now have to convince policymakers and educators of the value of this.
There's a circular problem with recognition. In order to get it recognised by educational authorities, including government, you need to be able to have a way of reliably identifying it, and I think we've got that. You also need to have a way of reliably helping the kids who have that problem, and I think we're on the way to that. But until we've got those two elements in place, parents are not going to say, I want my child to be identified as having this particular problem and to get this kind of help for that problem. And without the parents getting active about it, governments aren't going to get active about it. And if you look at the history of dyslexia, it's because the parents of dyslexic individuals were very vocal that governments recognised it. So what we need is for the current government in the UK and presumably in Australia as well to recognise that this is a problem where you can identify the individuals, you can help the individuals, and that actually it makes economic sense to put in place programs to identify and help dyscalculic learners.
Counting sheep when you're trying to sleep, being fair.
We don't expect for her to become a scientist or to work in that field, but we feel that it's important for her to have enough maths to get her through school and to get her through life, you know, just the everyday maths of working out your interest rate, counting back change, all the basic things that we use in everyday life.
My teachers, it might help them know that I don't know. Like, it's not, I don't want to listen, like, she's explaining on the board and I say, I don't understand, and they say, you're not listening. It will help them know, okay, well, she really does not understand.
As you may, you just can't get away from mathematics.
Lucy with her mum Astrid, and before them Professor Brian Butterworth, Associate Professor Bob Reeve and Dr. Nola Firth.
speaking to producer Corinne Podger. Details and oodles of extra resources about dyscalculia on our website, as ever, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, and on my blog, extra audio, including an extended interview with Brian. If there's a man that makes numbers sexy, he's the one. And more on efforts to have dyscalculia recognised in the next edition of the DSM, or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, by the American Psychiatric Association. We'll have to see how that goes. So now to your experiences, I want to hear them as a parent or a person challenged by numbers, or not. Perhaps you're a maths whiz. Love your stories, particularly on our Audio Boo pilot channel. Look for Speak Your Mind on the website and follow the instructions. Or there's the comments board on this week's page too. Thanks to studio engineer Carrie Dell. I'm Natasha Mitchell. More Heady Talk next week. Bye for now.
Do you find it annoying when driving between towns you can't tune to Radio National? Well, this summer, don't put up with it. Take Beachpod with you. At Beachpod, you can load up your MP3 player with loads of great Radio National podcasts. They're listed in various topics, and there's bound to be one that takes your fancy. For all the details, drive straight to the Radio National homepage. abc.net.au/rn